the denial of God. And the reason for that observation is that if we really accept the fullness of God, we also accept his death, and we die daily in Christ, and there therefore is no need to hold on to the mandate to prove ourselves. We can fail, and we can help other people to renewed life. And this freedom the Christian has through the cross and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And for that reason we can help patients to come to a good death if that is mandated, or we can help them through to renewed life if that is the situation. The point that Kübler-Ross makes and the point that Becker make is that all too often, because of the mandate to succeed and to prove ourselves, we are not free enough to let the will of God, theologically speaking, prevail, either for the patient to die or for the patient to come to renewed life. I was struck, I had to make that observation because I read an article by Parsons, Fox and Litz. This is a team of three sociologists who have made observations, a rather long article in one of the leading sociological journals. The basic theme of which article is that other people die vicariously our own death. When they die, this team of three sociologists addresses itself specifically to the medical ethical issue of physicians not capable, being capable, or patients' relatives, in fact, not being capable of facing death. And so they argue that patients die vicariously our own death, so that we do not need to be afraid of them dying. Specifically, physicians do not need to be afraid of them dying. Just like Jesus Christ died our death for us, therefore freeing us from the mandate to prove ourselves and to be strong in our own right, so also patients die the death for us. Now this is a very novel notion. At first I didn't understand. When a colleague in the sociology department at Russell Sage, where I teach, told me this and made this observation to me that I should read that article. By myself, I'm not too fluent in the sociological literature, so I'm very helpful if colleagues from another department point out to me literature which is relevant for me. And this colleague in the sociology department explained the basic thesis, and then I picked up those articles myself and read them, and then I understood after having read them myself. With this prior observation, which I think in my experience these things need to be discussed because they are not understood at the first confrontation, as I myself didn't understand that. But with this prior observation, I would like to get into a case study again in order to show in close, precise, actually happened detail how this theological observation can work itself out. In one of the first meetings at the pediatrics department in the Albany Medical Center, I sat down with the department chairman, Dr. Porter, for a staff meeting. And we were still sitting in that little room. Space is always at a premium in modern medical centers. We sat down in the little room waiting for others to come when all of a sudden a loud bell rang indicating that there had been a cardiac arrest in one of the patients. It happened to be a little black boy who was a Down syndrome child, a mongoloid child. I was told at the first meeting that I don't express some of my words appropriately. If you do not understand anything, please say right away that you don't, you know, maybe my accent is responsible for the mispronunciation. It's specifically the word mongolism, I think, was not understood. Sometimes I use the word Down syndrome. That's the medical term, and I was told that if at all possible one should use the word Down syndrome in order to get away from some of the negative associations related to the word Mongolism. In any case, this little black boy arrested. He had, maybe my wife can fill me in here again about the precise condition. He had, as is frequently the case with Mongolism, a heart problem. In addition to that, he had had a problem with seizures. And the seizures were not capable of being treated with medications. He had had one arrest before, and the way, if I understand it correctly, the seizures stop the breathing, yes? And yes. The breathing then stops the heart to beat, mm-hmm. Yes? And the nurses observed that such critical children are usually on monitors, and the monitors, when the heart stops beating or the breathing stops beating, I think both, yes? Mm-hmm. The monitors indicate the fact that life is at the point of ceasing, just like our fire alarms here. life is at the point of ceasing, and something should be done. And then everybody rushes into the room. We immediately, all of us, ran to the room and saw that, at first we didn't see anything because there were so many people in a small hospital room, about 20 people standing around, and two physicians in particular trying to resuscitate the boy. When the bell rings that there is an arrest, and when there is no specific instruction not to resuscitate, resuscitation commences automatically. Resuscitation was successful, and not too long, I think, if I remember correctly, that afternoon or the next day, we had a conference around the boy's bed. And I remember very clearly how Dr. Porter took a flashlight and pointed and tried to see whether there is any fluctuation in the size of the pupil as response to the light, which was not the case, or at least there was only very little. In other words, the seizures had damaged the activity of the brain so much that he was hardly capable of seeing, if at all. The same was true with attempts to determine ability to hear. And there was almost no ability to communicate by hearing and responding appropriately. Of course, the boy was alive. He was breathing, his heart was beating again, and he was a lovely child from all outward appearance. But the previous seizures and the two arrests had made this case indeed very critical. After having investigated the boy, this is a teaching hospital, and the professor, of course, tries to teach the students, the medical students, or the residents, or the interns, how you determine the amount of damage and what kind of damage is present. After that, there was a staff meeting in which, because probably partially also because of my presence, the ethical issues were investigated. Dr. Porter, the department chairman, asked, okay, how often do you resuscitate? This boy is a boy with serious cardiac problems. I should mention also that the parents dearly loved the child and had waited, I think, if I remember correctly, a long time for the child, and had therefore some hesitation to debate the issue of how often to resuscitate. In any case, it so happened that the primary physician was on vacation when the boy had the second cardiac arrest, at which time the question how often to resuscitate or whether to resuscitate again was raised. Because of the second arrest, the situation of the boy had deteriorated so far that the question whether to resuscitate again, from the physician's point of view, at least became a legitimate question to ask. So the staff meeting was held and the question was raised. I asked then whether the parents had been engaged in this conversation, because if you're not going to resuscitate, the parents are the ones who are going to have to give that permission. I was informed that the parents had not even been confronted with the issue, partly because of their own hesitancy to raise that issue, because they love their child so dearly. And partly also because, of course, the situation had deteriorated because of the second arrest. The third reason probably was the fact that the primary physician had just gone on vacation. It was decided that the parents should be confronted and should be finally told about the gravity of the patient and to be asked whether to resuscitate the patient again. Now, these two things I would just like to mention at this point. I have another case study later on to point out another slightly different issue. But these two points I would like to mention, and I would like, if possible, if you want to discuss this, to have a discussion. I'd just like to reiterate these two points. First of all, that the theological point that I wanted to make, which was pointed out to me, at least in its basic outlines, by a team of three sociologists, Parsons, Fox, and Litz, on the vicariousness of other people's dying for us, which then I theologically interpreted a little bit more broadly, namely that Jesus has died for us, and therefore we need to have no fear of proving ourselves. That was the first point. And then the second point, the case study that I have related to you. I assume that there are probably some questions which need to be pointed out in greater detail.
I don't get the connection between the case study and your first premise about Christ dying, therefore free from the mandate to succeed.
Well, as I had indicated, there is at least, I'm not so sure now, having actually been in a hospital and having actually seen how physicians think and operate, whether this basic premise is correct, but the prevalent notion in the seminars that are taking place around the country about the fear of death, which are perpetuated by Kubler-Ross and by others, indicates that physicians automatically want to heal, and that there is no room for theme of euthanasia, that is, that at certain times the patient should be permitted to die. And the reason for that is that physicians have to prove themselves. Now, in the case of this mongoloid child, the hesitancy, now I had tried to point out all the complexity of the case and tried to be as historically correct as possible as far as the case was concerned. I must say that there was probably a hint on my part that there was some hesitancy on the part of the physicians to confront the patient, to confront the patient's family with the gravity of the damage that had been done to the child, and to talk it over so that a permission could be given not to resuscitate. And the reason for that is that the ability to fail is a great strength which not everybody has. And this, then, the ability to fail, I would like to theologically explain, the freedom to be able to fail, to face the situation, which is really excruciating in the proper sense of the word. The word excruciating contains the word crux, the Latin word crux, which means cross. It's an excruciating experience for anyone, if someone under who, someone who is in your care dies. And this is especially so if you are responsible, if you are entrusted with that patient.
You can also say that the physician is trained to save life and not to destroy life.
Yes.
If you realize that one of your patients is going to die, then it's on the part of the physician a hard decision to make. And then to relate this to the parents or to the relatives is difficult for a physician to realize. And then if he himself has difficulties facing death, he has difficulties relating it to the relatives. And it was in this case with the little boy that the physicians themselves did not realize or did not want to admit this child was dying.
Yes, Kübler-Ross in her book on death and dying, and I have just been told that yesterday a new shipment of that book has come into our bookstore, relates of a case of a man with Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, and the man has had several crises and he wanted to die, but the resident was unable to accept that and he saved him, got him through a crisis, but the patient was after that, I think that was the illness, I'm not quite sure now whether it in fact was, but in any case, the patient got through the crisis but didn't really improve. He was sort of in limbo and couldn't talk and couldn't communicate in any way. He was living merely because the resident wanted him to live.
Yeah.
And at that point, this happened at the University of Chicago Medical Center, at that point the physician no longer knew what to do. You know, he didn't improve, he didn't deteriorate, so he went to Kübler-Ross and told him about the case, because Kübler-Ross had been carrying on such seminars on death and dying. And Kübler-Ross talked it over with him and pointed out that possibly he had a fear of failing. And after the physician realized that possibly he might have a hang-up, he went to the patient and became immensely resourceful and developed some method of communicating with the patient, because for the first time he engaged with the patient in a genuine sense, you know, as a genuine human being who is free. The patient began to respond by certain signs with his finger, which he could move, and the patient improved. But it was only because of this discussion with Kübler-Ross that freedom had developed on the part of the physician.
Yeah, there's the other question that sometimes the patient himself wants to die. And we read that in newspapers, or the relatives want the patient to die in dignity, as we read it so frequently in the last time. And the question arises, is it possible for the physician to let the patient go? And should we give in to a patient who wants to die? What if he changes his mind after some trial or after some difficulties? And he gets better. What if he changes his mind and he does not, in fact, want to die? These are very important questions and very important
issues
that a physician or his relatives, the relatives of the patients, are confronted with. And that may be a question for the discussion also. What can a relative, or what can a physician, or whoever is relates to the patient, can he do if a patient requests to die?
Please.
I might give a brief illustration of that is very much related to Holden Village. That there was a young couple who were here last summer at Holden Village, and they were in a tragic car accident on the way from Holden Village. The 15th of August last summer, the young lady's name is Linda Hewitt. They pray for her every week here at the village, and she was in the hospital in Minneapolis. She had written a statement sometime prior to that accident that if ever she were in an accident and were in sort of out of touch with the world and so on, she should be permitted to die.
Yes.
And she was, I saw her every week for many, many, many weeks. There was a sign over her bed, speak as if Linda understands. We don't know if she understands or not. She opened her eyes but did not focus. It was really, anyway, after many, many weeks, beginning for this accident was in the 15th of August, perhaps last April or March sometime, I heard that she began to respond, and the first time that I ever saw any response, I asked her one day, can you blink for me today? And she blinked very emphatically. That was a real moment. And then she began little by little to come out of this and to be able to spell out letters on a board, to spell words. And on one of those days, when we, after some weeks, when we began to be able to talk, and she did not talk, to get through to each other, she could hear and she could then point, I discussed with her the fact that she had made this kind of statement, written this, and I asked her, do you now want to live? And on the board, in addition to the letter that had yes and no, she pointed to yes.
Mm-hmm.
And the last time I saw her before coming here, she's in a nursing home now, and she's not able to write, and she wrote, "I want to go home." And I think that's an illustration
this
of what...
This is a very good illustration of what I mean, that sometimes you just cannot make a decision only because the patient requests it.
Yes. Such statements of intent that you want to die a death with dignity and that you don't want to be saved as a cripple, I think, are usually made in abstraction. I've seen it in my brother, who is now a quadriplegic. He had never thought too much about the question, but about a little more than a year ago now, he had an almost tragic accident. And
almost fatal.
And he continues, now if he would have thought more about it, he's in literature and he didn't think too much about the question, but it may well be that he would have decided, no, I don't want to live in that kind of condition where everything has to be made for me. And his shirt has to be buttoned up by his wife for him, everything, you know, he can't do anything by himself. And coming out here, we visited him and we saw an amazing will to succeed on his own, in his own condition, and if he had decided prior not to be wanted to be maintained in this condition, then you can clearly see a contradiction between that, but that's the contradiction of life, if I understand it correctly. I am sometimes rather despondent and really don't want to continue living, and then at other times I see great hope. That's the great problem confronting the psychiatrists with suicide cases. And of course I did, in the first session that we had, I did mention a Jehovah's Witness woman. And that, for me, was an indication of this case study. The Jehovah's Witness woman had a bad car accident. She didn't want to have a blood transfusion, but later on, when she did get one on her husband's permission, she was very happy. And this, for me, is an indication of the abstractness of that kind of reflection about one's own life. Yes.
I just got a comment on suicide. I believe it was Dr. Farber over somewhere in California a few years ago. Give a lecture about suicide prevention, and the question, of course, is raised, why not let them commit suicide? Why do you do all these things? And his answer was, because in case after case, these people who have been prevented from committing suicide are later deeply grateful. Thank you for what you did to stop me from doing what I then sincerely wanted to do.
Yeah, there is a better answer to that, and I do have a case study later on to follow that up. There is a better answer, at least for me, a rather convincing answer, I have read about in Lancet or one of the, no, I think it's called English Journal of Psychiatry, one of the leading British journals of psychiatry, conducted by an English psychiatrist on 100 suicide cases. And the overwhelming evidence indicates that suicides are mentally ill, and when they are ill, you treat them, and the suicide attempt is a form of illness, so therefore you should prevent them from committing suicide. Now that was rather convincing to me, even though in my own mind I discussed this with colleagues in Albany during the last 2 years at great detail, and I still think that there are certain instances, in spite of that article, there are certain instances I think where a man who is perfectly reasonable can commit suicide, and where the theologians and the minister I think might permit that will to prevail.
That's Van Dusen case.
I was going to present the Van Dusen case to you, if you want me to. But maybe there are some other questions to talk about the other issues. You had your hand up there.
In this whole issue, where does the community fit in? I'm talking not just the individual involved, whether the person deciding to die or not. You talk about suicide. I think of one case that I got quite. The young ambulance attendant. He could have been 18 years old, but as he wheels out the person on a gurney, he says, "Suicide's the loudest cry for help we ever hear." I thought, "Wow, this guy's profound."
Mm-hmm.
But the mutual support of family. We've put so much of this issue on the
physician. What about the family's ability to come to grips with it and say to that physician, what's the score here? And then, do they make a decision for the person? Where is this mutuality? Where is this fellowship, this community, whatever term? Is this what Christianity has to offer?
Yes.
We give life. We give support for life here. Yes. We give support for life eternally.
Yes.
What's the responsibility of those of us who sit here for those persons we know, whether it be the person or not?
Yes, indeed. I think the family is very, very important. And in primitive societies, let me not say it that way, in other civilizations, apart from our Western industrialized civilizations, where the extended family still exists, there is a support which we no longer know, and even though mental illness may be prevalent there also, it is taken care of. And my wife, for one, is of the opinion that many psychiatrists could be spared if we could be better friends, and that many a mental patient really needs friends. And I believe that too. Even though I, and my wife I'm sure would agree, there is mental illness, and I was convinced of that when I spent week after week in the locked psychiatric ward in the Albany Medical Center last term. There is real mental illness which can be separated from aberrant behavior. There's no question about that. Or from simple emotional lability or flexibility. Maybe we should discuss the Van Dusen situation, and I would like to just tell the case and then make a few remarks about the reasons why Western civilization has always had an opposition against permitting a patient to die. Van Dusen, you know, was the president of Union Theological Seminary for many, many years. He was a theologian respected around the world and known around the world. He got to be in his 80s, and also his wife, when they continued still to be living in their Manhattan estate, in their Manhattan house. And it was one of the old big houses, difficult to take care of. Their children had for years and years urged them that this must cease sometime, that they must give up their house, they can't take care of it anymore, and that they would have to live in some other circumstances, and the circumstances that were urged upon them is to go into a good nursing home. Now, they were not nursing cases, but they were beginning to be old, and they needed some care. In any case, they couldn't take care of their house themselves anymore. Now, that struck them as they were afraid of that for years and years, and so finally they decided that they would write a suicide pact. And they argued, they gave theological arguments why it is permissible for a Christian in his complete in complete control of his mind to take his life. They took their overdose of sleeping pills, both of them, put the note on the table, and maybe 12 hours later or so they were found. Somebody tried to visit them and they knew that they were there. And the house was broken into and they were found. Now, they were brought to the hospital immediately. Now, if you were the physician, what would you have done? This is a suicide case, but of course it is related to euthanasia, because the physician would have to decide either to let the patient have his will, you know, so he would have to permit the good death to occur, or do anything in his power, as the Hippocratic Oath mandates on him, do everything in his power to permit him to come, to permit them to come back to life. I must add one other thing. I think maybe I should mention that later. But what would you do if these two people for all practical purposes, as far as anyone can tell, in complete control of their mind, one of the few cases of suicides where apparently no mental illness is prevalent, except that you might define any state of depression or any state of wanting to terminate your life as by itself already an indication of mental illness. Some psychiatrists say just that. They say any desire to end your life is by itself a manifestation of mental illness. But I would not want to go so far. I think that there are certain circumstances where mental illness, where this definition should not be used, and where a person in complete control of his mental ability, of his mental powers, can commit suicide. How would you have acted if you were the physicians, if these two patients had come to you?
I think it's a very unfair question. A physician has no choice. He really doesn't. A physician is the Hippocratic Oath, demands it. I think we're putting an awful lot of pressure on the physician for the decision. You have to respect them.
The physician enters a covenant relationship of trust with the patient. This is one of the basic cardinal points which Ramsey makes in his book, Patient as Person, and in his other two books on medical ethics that he has written. Now, if in this instance he is confronted with the suicide pact and with a clear wish on the part of the patient that he wants to die, might it not be possible on the part of the physician to honor that will? I mean, if he has a relationship of trust with the patient, might that not be possible? In fact, perhaps possibly mandated. Why should it go contrary? I think physicians are probably very well aware of the fact that that the desire to pull through, the desire to live on the part of the patient, is a very necessary ingredient of therapy. And if this desire is not there, then whatever the physician will do will end in failure.
Doesn't it, in this situation, as in all others, that it is so difficult to generalize? It depends upon the specifics of the situation. And I know Dr. I knew him when I was a student in the seminary, but I know nothing about the later things beyond hearing that there were, in addition to the fact that they were grieving the loss of their home and so on, they were very serious, that he had had 2-3 strokes and he couldn't talk, and she had arthritis. And there were all kinds of complicated factors. I think if I were the doctor and they were brought in, I think I would do what I could to save their lives.
Yes.
But at the same time, I might feel some resentment to them that they hadn't been more efficient in their own. If they wanted to do it, why did they get me into it?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
I really agree with him. If you're working in an emergency room, you have no choice. You must do what you must do. Now, if they assigned to a doctor, I don't remember the specifics, but if they assigned to a particular physician to be called in and entered them, then no problem.
Yes.
Because then it is a mutual, this community again.
Yes.
The community that can really strengthen one another. Have seen this, where machines have been turned off, where it's been a mutuality of a family versus physician. And it's a very normal, happy, in the best sense of the term, complete thing. It's a beautiful thing.
Yes.
But a physician who's a stranger, especially now with the pressure being put on legally.
Yes, that I think is
a whole other
ball. That's a very important factor.
But that physician has no choice. It's a stranger. If there's a mutually assigned fact and they said, take
it. Even if I were the family physician, I think in that case, I would still say, I'd do what I can to save his life. Even then, I think I would do that.
Yeah, always be done. And then you have to relate to the relative, I feel. If you cannot relate to the patient himself, you have to go to the family and discuss it, and then I think the family has to make the decision, and not the physician.
Well, this instance is particularly instructive because the tradition of physicians to heal is strongly influenced by the Judeo-Christian tradition, in addition, of course, to the Hippocratic Oath, which comes out of the Greek tradition. To do anything possible to help the organism to come back to its full potential. I had mentioned this the other day. Thou shalt not kill, I think, is probably the greatest, the most important mandate coming out of the Jewish tradition. I am toning down my own sort of, as I see it now, the sort of sweet, melancholic issue that is prevailing in the country, or going, you know, racing through the country, especially among younger people, that you must permit death with dignity. When I began teaching medical ethics, I realized that, subjectively only, that this was really, you know, a great theme, and students just love that, and they eat it up, you know. But increasingly, I am dedicated to the prevention of life, and increasingly I identify myself with a physician's mandate to save life wherever possible. Thou shalt not kill. And conversing with physicians a great deal, and also with my wife, of course, I realize that the subjective, the subconscious dedication to prevent to prevent death is not can should not only be explained in those terms in which Ernest Becker and Kubler-Ross present the whole cultural preoccupation with life. You know, here I must say to you now that I have two very themes varying with one another, and I begin to think about death in a different way than I had once upon a time.
Well, as long as we're sharing subjectively, I'll share something subjective and ask your reaction.
Yeah.
That I personally found it much easier for me subjectively to accept the kind of thing that the Van Dusen did at the end of life. Things were closing in, there was limited future there.
Yes.
Than I do in counseling with the woman who was maybe 4 or 5 months pregnant and who says, I would like to get an abortion. Now, it is, that we are, our first baby was born 5 months along and lived an hour, and I stood by that little crib and saw that little girl there, and the doctor said she cannot live. So I think of deliberately ending a life of a child, that just breaks me up out of it. And yet that goes on, that is accepted, and that's it. And at the same time, people get all worked up over the Van Dusen, where they make a personal decision. I wonder what's your reaction, subjectively or theologically? I confess mine is very subjective. I think it's somewhat theological too.
Well, I think, as I've mentioned the last time or the time before then, that we are a society in great contradiction, but that we think of reality in very abstract terms. And what some of the members of the faculty here have said about the American dream and the inconsistency of the American dream, for me, is very... very well presented in the medical situation. For example, the schooling, one of the things that I wanted to raise in that forum where the Miss America was raised for the first time, the myth, of course, was perpetuated with the idea of schooling, which I think was mentioned, in fact. We can, or by it was mentioned at a later time, we believe that we can perpetuate the American myth by schooling, and then we got into all the, you know, we tried to get rid of the aftermath of slavery by equal education also for the blacks, and so busing became necessary. We are a nation which believes that things are perfectible. Now, we realize that out of the slums come mainly, or out of the low socioeconomic areas come all those many cases which are problems as far as abortions are concerned. The better to do, the middle class cases, either have the money, or the upper class cases, either have the money, or they have the ability to make, they have the money either to obtain an abortion prior to the abortion ruling of 73, or they have the ability to maintain the child. But the low economic bracket is that class which is problematic. And so, in our attempt to solve the problems radically, as we have raised the slums and have built impersonal skyscrapers, therefore only perpetuating the problems in our big cities, so also we have attempted to erase the problem, the social problems, which arise with unwanted pregnancies by an abortion ruling of 73. I may mention that in Germany, the Supreme Court also made, shortly after our United States Supreme Court ruling on abortion in 73, had also, I think in 1974, had a ruling very similar to ours. And in 75, the Supreme Court in Germany, Western Germany, reversed itself, saying that each life has the right to life. Liberty and the pursuit of happiness, of course, could be mentioned also. But the primary life by the modern West German constitution is life, just like in our American constitution. I think it is unconstitutional to have an abortion ruling as we have had in 73, which was strengthened just recently when the Supreme Court said, yes, teenagers need not consult their parents. They can have an abortion by themselves. Without consulting parents, or women need not get the permission of their husbands. They can have an abortion all by themselves. That's the way I feel. And of course, you know, then we have now a death sentence ruling. I come from Germany, and I must say this whole, increasingly, I must say this whole issue of euthanasia, of control of behavior, which is increasingly prevalent, the abortion ruling, the death penalty ruling, for me, for the German, is very suspect. One of the things I wanted to do here, and maybe I can get it in this way now, is to, you know, mention some of these inhibitions which we have had due to the recent experience in our Western civilization. Germany, during the Nazi regime, has had little hesitation as far as euthanasia was concerned. They had their notions of what mankind should be. Emancipation, for example, didn't belong there. Jews didn't belong there either. What kind of an image of man do you need to have in order to be able to practice medicine adequately? For me, the poor cripple, the sinner, certainly belongs there, the cripple in heart. And for me, there is no great difference between the cripple in heart and the physical cripple. And in fact, I see very often the physical cripple to be a much better Christian than the person who has a perfect body. And I think that is what is important. And also, as far as Mongolism is concerned, many people feel themselves incapable of caring for a Mongoloid child. I ask myself, where would I be if I would not have been cared for in spite of the ability to do anything for myself when I was a baby? That's for me one of the greatest things that we inherit, that we are able as a small child to take things freely, and even as adults. We learn that as children to receive things freely, as we receive God's gift, of course, also God's gift of life and redemption freely. And for me, therefore, the mental patients which were gassed by the Nazis are as full human beings as children are, which are normal. And as we all are, I mean, in fact, they are more in need of protection. Their human dignity, which they have because God's grace shines also on them, is in greater need of protection than the normal people's protection, just like we protect babies and children more than we protect adults, because adults can take care of themselves. So that's where I stand.
I find it very difficult for me to evaluate this Anderson case with the information that you have given us,
yes.
Because what I understand theologically completely precludes suicide. And I cannot find anything in my recall that would in any way justify, you know, this theological interpretation that he presented, that he, you know, put in his notes. I just cannot comprehend what it could possibly have been. How he could have theologically figured out a way that would justify taking his life. And that's from God. So I can't make a judgment concerning the case without all the information.
Suicides are a special category by themselves. We have discussed this case in a group of theologians, ethicists, psychiatrists, and physicians at the Albany Medical Center. And we have discussed suicide in a broader context also, not only the Van Dusen case. And one psychiatrist mentioned to me the following story. A patient in his care
well, a patient came in his care, and the patient had gone, had been sent around from psychiatrist to psychiatrist, and everybody tried to dissuade him from taking his own life. The patient complained of being unsuccessful, and the psychiatrist always slapped him on the back and said, "You're not a failure, you're a good guy, you must believe in yourself." So he had been going, you know, he was distraught, you know, he couldn't accept himself. And so he finally came into the care of this colleague at the medical center in Albany, and he decided to change the tactic. He looked at this man's life, and indeed, there wasn't very much there. And indeed, the man was a failure at almost anything that he did. And so he decided to level with him and to be honest with him, and he said, "Yes, I agree with you. You are a failure in life." This was a revelation to the patient, that for the first time somebody agreed with him and that he was honest with him, and a relationship of trust developed, and an ability to communicate with the patient that helped the patient who wanted to take his life to reverse himself and to build on the old, you know, on what he was. He had been a failure, yes, but maybe he should restructure his life altogether. And the will to take his life vanished. But only because this particular psychiatrist decided in our discussion, he was together with me and one other, it was a small group of 8 or 9 only. And this colleague in psychiatry, Hasenfeld is his name, and I decided that yes, this is one of the few cases, the Van Dusen case is one of the few cases where I would probably agree that taking his own life would be legitimate. I would, as a physician, probably not. I would do whatever I could to save his life nonetheless. I don't know why I would be, because I would be cowardly, but if I would be presented in the hospital, to tell you what I think, if I would be in the hospital there and he would be wheeled in, I would pump out his stomach and do whatever I could in order to save him. But the moral issue still is there, and I would probably say yes, I would be in favor, I would not have any great scruples in him taking his own life.
What was the outcome?
Did they die? Excuse me, I do want to tell the outcome in just a minute, but I didn't hear that question.
How did that die with thou shalt not kill?
Thou shalt not kill is something else than taking your own life.
I don't see that. Taking my life is killing too.
I'm not a great advocate of suicide. I share with you these the sense of that. But I think it's interesting for us. We say there are many situations in which it's right to take someone else's life. The Christian Church has historically had all kinds of people who have said that it is fine to kill at war. It is fine to take capital punishment to punish somebody. I really think it is much more questionable in those cases that I have the right to take someone else's life, that it may be somehow in some strange situation, you know, I'm being tortured to give away some deep secret that will result in destroying the whole nation, that maybe I should, in that situation, sacrifice myself. I was involved in a suicide situation in a former parish where a woman took her own life. We had counseled for hours. I was a failure there, no doubt. But she felt, from her perspective, she was sacrificing herself on behalf of her family. She had so much suffering, so much misery. I think she made a mistake. I do not think she is condemned in the grace of God. I think that she died, I believe, of an illness in that case.
Yes.
And said that in the funeral service, that I felt she died of an illness. And I just think that if, on the one hand, if we are so easy to permit capital punishment, war, all this kind of stuff, we should have a little more mercy, perhaps, towards those who decide to take their own life.
I guess I don't have some, I can't accept the taking of life.
I must say, at this point, I'm constantly in development of my thought, as I'm sure you are too, but at this point, I must say, I can say nothing else except that I have no system to get this feeling, to argue for this feeling, and it is only because of the feeling of pity, not pity, but the feeling of compassion which I have for such people, that I permit myself to have this thought. Otherwise, I am very much in agreement with you, but from this perspective of compassion, I must say, your unwillingness, which to let only one iota from the command not to kill enter into your thoughts sounds slightly dogmatic. Yes. And maybe I should do away with my own opinion too. And it's good that we have a discussion here. Go ahead.
As a theologian, you must have studied in some detail the theological basis which Van Heusen developed to justify their own mind.
Yes, in coming
their action.
Yeah.
Would you share with us some of the theological bases upon which they justify their action?
Well, unfortunately, I must admit that I have not been able to read their document, and the reason why I didn't try to obtain the document after we had discussed it now, I guess 8 months ago in that circle on medical ethics in the faculty that we have at the medical center, is because the person who presented that case to us couldn't get the document either, and I assumed that it was very difficult to obtain. So I didn't make any greater attempt to find that document.
Hasn't there been writing about it in the theological journals?
Well, the American Theological Journal possibly may have carried articles which I myself did not read. There is a whole lot of literature on suicide per se, and I assume that there is literature on the Van Heusen case which I did not read though. But the theological argument against suicide, of course, is clear. The theological argument is essentially based on the mandate not to kill, and also for the mandate not to take your own life. This, of course, the Protestant Church shares with the Catholic Church, that God has given us our physical life. This comes out of the Jewish tradition, which honors the physical body a great deal. And especially in the Catholic tradition, there has been a strong, but also in the Protestant tradition, there has been a strong mandate not to maim. For example, for that reason, the Catholic Church in particular has been very adamant not to permit transplantation. At first, not to maim the body, and that means, of course, self-maiming was also unpermitted. Okay, but the theological reasons for suicide, and again, I must admit that on the Van Heusen case, there was I did not read any more theological debate except what I had read in the New York Times. But a theological argument for suicide, I can now develop in this sense that there are certain circumstances where the despair in life is so great that you entrust yourself into the grace of God altogether. So that God's grace alone is that which is becoming important for you, which can mean death, which can mean under certain circumstances I think that is can be a statement of faith. As we are willing to die almost in any circumstance, the little death for our neighbor or for somebody else who is in our proximity or for our family or whatever, the little death, which does not mean our physical death, so we can also die the big death, that is the actual end of our life for somebody else. If life becomes unbearable for others, if our life becomes unbearable for others to take care of, I think suicide might under certain circumstances be mandated. But this, I must say, is only to relieve the great mandate to preserve life. To relieve it, not to make a system out of that. I think that, for example, for me, it is a mandate to preserve marriage. A divorce really doesn't have any place in my way of thinking. But we Protestants have been because we are, because we believe in God's grace, because we believe that God is not a person who sets up systems, and who, whose law shall prevail, in this instance the law of marriage, for the sake of mercy and compassion, certain couples should be permitted to be divorced, which we Protestant thinkers permit only with great hesitation, but because we have compassion, because we believe that there is a gracious God, under certain circumstances life is indeed unbearable. And for that reason also, I have been willing to permit abortions prior to 1973 under certain circumstances. Therapeutic abortion, for example, for the sake of the health of the mother, I have been willing to permit. Now, some theologians were unwilling to permit even that. But for the sake of mercy and for the sake of compassion, certain restrictions on the command to maintain life, I think, should be made. So that would be theologically arguing for suicide. Yes.
What about Apostle Paul? He said, you know, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain, one thing he was thinking about.
Yes, I have quoted Paul before. Paul, of course, squarely meets my definition of death as dying daily in Christ. And for Paul, there is therefore no fear of death, and therefore when he actually died in Rome, we hear little about it. We don't even know how he died. So there was probably little anguish. I think Paul was one of those people who died probably without great anguish, like Bonhoeffer also. There are actual accounts of Bonhoeffer dying, of Bonhoeffer anticipating death. And we have testimony from Bonhoeffer himself out of in his letters from prison, where he writes that other inmates in prison have told him that he is for them a pillar of faith. And he says, he writes in his diary or in his letters, he writes, I don't understand myself as a pillar of faith at all. I'm despaired. I'm despaired about the situation, but despite my despair, I trust God. You know, I'm not going to let my despair get in the way of living, because I know that Christ is my Redeemer. But it's because of Bonhoeffer's and probably Paul's ability, and I've been wondering, as I was thinking about these things, about Luther's death. I've never thought about that. Maybe one should think about Luther's death, about the way Luther confronted death. But there are indeed some heroes who are capable of confronting death in a Christian way. There are some Christians who are capable of confronting death in a Christian way. In the sense that they say, like Paul, if Christ wants me to live, then I will live. And if Christ wants me to die, then I will die. And I will not look at myself, at my despair or at my joy, at what I should be as a Christian, a pillar of faith or whatever, but rather I can, even as a Christian, be a despairing Christian under certain circumstances, I think. I am always a little bit uneasy when I hear people say about somebody else, oh, that other person cannot be a Christian because he's despairing. You can see it in his face. He's not a Christian. And the fact that he or she is so ill, and that he or she is always thinking about his illness, a sort of hypochondria, you know, is an indication that Christ is not in that person. Look at Job. Look at so many ill people in the Bible. Look at Paul himself, who had been afflicted. Paul also knew, you know, he had a certain illness. We don't know exactly what it was, but maybe an illness can also be, illness, and I include their mental illness now also, can also be a sign of living in Christ. I don't make that distinction. And I don't look at the outward person in order to determine. I don't want to measure the barometer of faith of somebody else, nor do I want to measure the barometer of faith or the thermometer of faith in myself.